Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
This week on the pod, the convoy comes to Ontario's capital city. The NDP stages its annual convention and boasts some pretty impressive election readiness numbers. And the Ontario government gets a bill from the teachers for $100 million. More on these stories straight ahead on this Tuesday, February 8th, 2022. So let's get to it. JMM, this past weekend, the so-called Freedom Convoy descended on the provincial capital. Interestingly enough, there wasn't that much disruption at Queen's Park, but there certainly was at the major intersection of Avenue and Bloor. So let's start with the basics. Any arrests? Any damage done? What can you tell us about that?
It certainly was a noisy event. We have reports of at least three smoke bombs being set off. There was one arrest, I believe, if I'm reading the Toronto Police report correctly, it was in connection with somebody being pelted with feces. No reports of major property damage or physical assaults, though, from Toronto Police.
Okay. The Ottawa Freedom Convoy, of course, has almost become an occupying force in the nation's capital. It's taken over the streets in ways that don't prevent any traffic getting through. Local businesses are being starved of customers. Even federal conservative politicians who were previously currying favor with the protesters, well, they're now saying, you've made your point, go home. And we also know some examples of appalling behavior, such as people carrying Confederate flags or swastikas, or ripping off food from food banks, disrespecting statues, monuments, etc., etc. Did we see any of that kind of stuff in Toronto this past weekend?
No, it was a very different story in Toronto from what we've seen in Ottawa. The Toronto Police blocked off the hospital row along University Avenue, which, if you don't know the city's geography, this is the street that Queen's Park is on, but just south of Queen's Park. So there was a lot of concern among leaders that the protests could interfere with people being able to access the hospitals. Avenue and Bloor itself was impassable, but it didn't get violent. Other roadways like the Gardiner Expressway were also blocked for a time, though that's also what we in Toronto call Saturday.
or any other day of the week for that matter. Yes,
well, exactly. And we could also acknowledge that, you know, Toronto Police had the example of Ottawa to learn from. They knew what was coming. The convoy was not allowed to take over the downtown core in Toronto in a way that it was able to in Ottawa. In Ottawa, there's been some news in the last few days. The mayor of Ottawa has declared a state of emergency. Ottawa residents are actually taking the protesters to court. They're seeking an injunction against the protest. Ottawa Police Chief Peter Slowly has said that the city just does not have the manpower to further control events. And now, just as we record this, just before we started recording, the federal government is proposing a trilateral table for the national, provincial, and local governments to organize and coordinate their response to these protests.
You know, it's interesting. The Solicitor General put out a press release this morning saying, you know, we've made adequate resources available to the police in Ottawa. So, I mean, essentially it was one of these, if you don't like what's happening, don't blame us because we've made adequate resources available. The Ottawa police are definitely saying something different, aren't they?
Absolutely. The provincial government has stated that they provided 1,500 officers to the city of Ottawa to help with their response. It turns out that if you want to talk about actual individuals in, you know, uniforms, that might be more like 100. There's some debate between Ottawa and Queen's Park as to whether it's 100 or 150. Certainly, the initial number that the province made public does not seem to actually, it's certainly not anything like 1,500 uniformed officers helping out in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm. Now, Doug Ford has, of course, said a lot of controversial things over the years, but he got himself into some difficulty this past week when he talked about the protesters. This was on the radio show Good Morning Hamilton with Rick Zamprin.
You know, I just hope it's always a peaceful protest. We live in a democracy. If people want to come down and protest, God bless them. I understand their frustration.
There's your Hamilton reference for the week, by the way, so you always snuck that in. Anyway, let's talk about the impact of those words. What do you think it was, JMM?
Well, certainly it it opened the door for the premier's critics to come down hard on him. The New Democrat, Taras Nadashak, said Ford conservatives are pandering to extremists and coddling anti-vaxxers. Now, obviously, the premier and his government would disagree with that characterization. Of course, the province has been providing, you know, some assistance to try and help contain the protests. But both the federal and provincial conservative parties were, you know, on their heels over the past week, trying to defend their support for so-called reasonable people in the convoy who just want to protest peacefully versus the bad actors we've seen, the white supremacists, neo-Nazis, you know, people calling for the prime minister to be hung and charged with treason, etc., etc., etc.
We should correct their grammar. They're calling for the prime minister to be hanged, or they should be, not hung.
Yes, I'm sorry. Hanged and not hung. maybe sedition and not treason, too, if we want to be careful.
There you go. There you go. You know, I mean, we're making light of it here, but we shouldn't. But it's, you know, the fact is, this thing has really gotten out of hand. It's gotten a little crazy. It's now the subject of, you know, cable television fodder in the United States. The Liberal leader, Stephen Del Duca, held a news conference Monday morning to say that if the convoy members didn't begin to go home immediately, he would urge the taking of three specific actions. I guess he said, if I were premier, here's what I'd do to end what he called the occupation of Ottawa. The occupation. Okay, what did he have in mind?
Well, first, he wants the government, the provincial government, to declare a state of emergency. I think by this point in the pandemic, people should probably be pretty familiar with the Emergency Management and Civil Preparedness Act and what a state of emergency means. It gives very, very broad powers to the premier and to cabinet. So that has obviously been used during the pandemic multiple times. Mr. Del Duca would like to see it used to help contain and, I guess, dismantle the occupation. He's saying the protesters should leave now or lose your truck. He wants the government to confiscate these trucks as a form of basically civil asset forfeiture in the same way that, for example, clubs used by biker gangs can be seized by the state and then sold. Mr. Del Duca would like to see the same power used for these trucks and the other assets that have been brought to Ottawa by the protesters. And finally, he wants to force the organizers to reimburse the city for its policing costs. I have seen some people say that that might actually be something that is possible now because of the local declaration of emergency that Mayor Jim Watson declared. I have to confess, I haven't yet dug into the legality of that exactly, but it's certainly something that Mr. Del Duca and more than just Mr. Del Duca people are thinking about.
Now, I don't want anyone to misconstrue my next comments as saying Stephen Del Duca doesn't mean what he says when he just said that. Those would be very bold measures if the Premier of Ontario were to pick them up and implement them. But let's keep some of the politics in mind here. Stephen Del Duca can say all this, and it won't cost him a single vote because he has no votes among those truckers to begin with. And beyond that, he's got almost all the seats in that area, too.
Right. I mean, this is going to sound slightly cruel, and I don't mean it to be, but, you know, the Liberals don't have that many seats in the legislature, but the ones they have, a lot of them come from Ottawa. Mm-hmm. You know, this gives him a chance to look tough, to speak tough, and, you know, the Liberals have all of the seats except for, as it turns out, the one seat in which this is all happening, Ottawa Centre. It used to be Yasser Naqvi's riding before the 2018 election. He now represents that same riding federally. But currently, New Democrat Joel Hardin holds the riding. The Liberals obviously wouldn't mind to take that riding back, so it helps them to show a strong hand. But, you know, just to sort of circle back to how you started this remark, you know, I do think that a lot of people are also very sincerely angry about these events, and I think Mr. Del Duca's anger is also genuine. You know, while we're just talking about politics, I think it's also worth mentioning that Green Party leader Mike Schreiner has also called on the government to bring the legislature back 2 weeks early. Based on recent precedent, there have been other calls to bring the legislature back early. The government has not done that. So I don't think there's really any chance of that happening here.
Okay, let's move on, because while the convoy was doing its thing in downtown Toronto, 750 New Democrats were gathering virtually for their annual convention, the last one before June's general election. The NDP think they are very well situated to run a competitive campaign in a few months' time, maybe more so than ever. Let's go through it. Why do they think that, JMM?
Well, they are the official opposition. Let's just start off from that basis. Second largest party in the legislature. They are going to go into the campaign with more former sitting members than in any other election campaign, except for the time they formed government in the early 1990s. So, I mean, that alone is going to be a much better launching pad for the election than they've had, certainly since I've been old enough to vote. The NDP say they've also trained 20,000 team members as potential workers for that 2022 election campaign. The party reports that it has raised more than $5.1 million from more than 127,000 individual donations in 2021. That is more individual donations than every other party in Ontario combined. They voted on Andrea Horvath's leadership, and she scored an 85% approval rating. Good number, certainly good enough to stay on as leader. I don't think there was any speculation that she might lose, but nevertheless, an 85% approval rating. So, you know, the party is feeling pretty bullish about where they sit logistically on the eve of this election.
Now, I sort of sat in virtually on some of the leaders of the NDP convention over the weekend. And well, let me share a few takeaways, as they say. NDP conventions are traditionally really quite different from conservative or liberal conventions, because New Democrats are, well, what do we say? They are different. They, you know, they traditionally have incredibly intense policy debates about who's the most fervent socialist and this kind of thing. And unlike other parties, there are members of the labor movement that have guaranteed delegate status at this convention. When delegates introduce themselves, for example, if they want to speak on a motion, I'll give you an example here. This is what they say. They'll say, "My name is John Smith. My pronouns are he and him, or my pronouns are, you know, they and them. And I'm speaking from the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee people." Now, that is something you don't hear at the other party conventions. And the NDP pride themselves on being very inclusive. For example, there are reserve spots on the party's executive for so-called equity-seeking groups. So people can actually campaign for vice presidential positions openly as trans or two-spirit or LGBTQ. There are positions reserved for those equity-seeking groups as part of the NDP leadership. These are not the kinds of things that happen at other party conventions. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I guess I'd make two points about this. First, you know, this kind of language does spread, I think, in generally benign ways. I think about land acknowledgements in Canada. You know, Kathleen Wynne, as premier, she made a point of starting her speeches with land acknowledgements. Doug Ford has not continued that tradition, but I suspect if the next premier comes from a different party, that tradition will begin again in terms of, you know, what a premier of Ontario does to address people in Ontario. But that said, you know, sometimes this language really can end up mattering in elections if parties, and I think this is true of both the right and left, if they aren't careful about the language they use to speak amongst themselves and how it gets perceived by outsiders. And I want to take a specific example here and talk about in the last election, the NDP included a pledge to make Ontario, I believe the word was, a sanctuary province for undocumented migrants. Now, in terms of the actual policy impact of that claim, the NDP would be the first to tell you that it actually didn't matter very much. It was not going to change a lot on the ground. But it set off a lot of alarm bells in, let's say, some more conservative-leaning ridings, but places where, you know, particularly in southwestern Ontario, I think the party had hoped that they would pick up a few seats. And a lot of the postmortems of the last election, that sanctuary province thing came up a lot in terms of the kinds of things that the NDP sometimes do that turn off people who are not inside the tent and fluent in the code of progressive politics.
Right. I guess let me say one more thing about this convention, JMM, and that is, as you pointed out earlier, Andrea Horvath got a very strong number in terms of an endorsement of her leadership. I think her number this time was about 10 points higher than it was at the previous convention after the last election. So, you know, she's got a good, strong grasp of her party right now as she goes into what will be her fourth general election as NDP leader. That doesn't mean there isn't a decent-sized chunk, to be sure, a small minority, but a decent-sized chunk of people in the New Democratic Party who don't like her, who don't like her leadership, who don't like the dozens and dozens of policies that were and resolutions that were approved of at the convention. And again, this may be, I mean, every party has its, you know, minority that is unhappy with the leadership. But again, I think the NDP particularly so, which is why you sometimes got interventions from people who said, you know, I can't stand the way that this party has moved to the center. We need to be a virulently socialist party and stay true to our roots over on the far left. And, you know, this leader will never have my support as long as she continues to pander to centrists. And, you know, that's the kind of rhetoric you get out of this thing. Now, let's just clarify once again. It's a small minority of the people in the party, but they do make their presence felt. And it has ever been thus. I think that's what I want to say.
No, absolutely. And I think, it would not be an NDP meeting if the leader of the NDP in the present day was not getting screamed at by somebody to their left to be even more progressive. And in the same way, there is not a present day leader of any New Democratic Party anywhere in Canadian politics who does not get compared unfavorably to one of their predecessors who, in their day, was also getting yelled at for not being far left enough.
Very true. Okay, let's talk vaccine passports, because the Chief Medical Officer of Health, Kieran Moore, now says the province may need to rethink the whole passport system. What's going on there?
So we have a status quo in Ontario right now, where if you get two doses of one of the approved vaccines, you count as fully vaccinated for the purposes of the vaccine certificate. But what has changed since the certificate system was implemented is that, you know, medical experts now believe that three doses is vastly superior to the protection offered by two doses. And so the chief medical officer seemed to be leaving the door open, let's say, to whether the province might actually have to change its vaccine passport system so that people would need to get a third dose if they do not already have one to access the kinds of things that are currently controlled by the vaccine passport system. That's, you know, bars, restaurants, movie theaters, etc. Moore did also say that the province wants to get federal input on what the restrictions should be, because, of course, the federal government is also using the vaccine passport system for international visitors. Remember that these systems are all tied together, so there's a lot of moving parts here, and there's a fair argument that whatever Ontario wants to do, it can't really just move on its own. We should also, however, I think, be talking about the possibility that the government will simply drop the vaccine passport altogether rather than extend it to three doses.
Now, that, I presume, would be controversial for a government that still gets an earful from some people who say it isn't doing enough to control COVID spread.
Well, you know, there's nothing they can do at this point that wouldn't be controversial, right? I mean, just look at the protests in Ottawa. Imagine what that would be like if Doug Ford were to announce tomorrow that it's mandatory three doses now. So I guess, you know, in terms of thinking about where this might go over the next few months, I would say, look at the calendar. As we record this, it's early February. About 45% of Ontarians have had three doses today. It's actually 55% of all adults, and another 40% have had two doses. So, you know, we are averaging about 30,000 third doses a day right now. And so you could imagine we'll probably get to 60% of the province's adults before long. And for the older age groups, especially, you know, those 70 and older, those percentages are already much higher than the province-wide averages. So I think for the government, the question is going to be, is the juice they would get in terms of increased third dose uptake worth the squeeze of changing the vaccine passport system at a time when, and we've discussed this before, you know, what they really clearly want to be able to do is go into the next election campaign, which of course starts in early May, and tell voters that, hey, all of the public health measures have been lifted. Honestly, I mean, if you're asking me today, I don't think that they are going to do it. I think they would sooner drop the vaccine passport system than extend it to three doses.
I learned some new political expressions from you today, because I do remember my Poli-Sci 101 course at U of T many, many years ago, and I don't recall the expression the juice or the squeeze ever coming up in that class.
You've never heard the phrase, is the juice worth the squeeze?
I have now. That's a good one. Yeah, I haven't heard it in relation to politics, but that's a good one. Okay, good. Okay, JMM, I'm sure from time to time you get a bill in the mail at your home telling you, I don't know what, you got to pay your hydro bill or whatever. Have you ever received a bill? I'm just curious. Have you ever received a bill for $103 million?
No, I have not.
Lucky you. But unlucky Ontario government. The Ontario government just did. A judge has ruled that the previous Liberal government under Premier Dalton McGuinty, we're going back 10 years ago now, that government violated the collective bargaining rights of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario when the government brought in a bill arbitrarily determining what the contract settlement with the teachers would be, and therefore damages have been awarded to the tune of $103 million. What do you think of that?
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of money, and it sounds like that because it is a lot of money. But in the world of provincial policymaking, you know, that actually just represents 0.06% of the Ontario budget. So, you know, the province can afford to write that check, and, you know, we are all going to pay our own fraction of that check, unless, of course, the government appeals that decision. They might. We don't have word on that yet. But I think this is likely to be a lesson for governments in the future, since the whole point of legislating teacher compensation back in 2012 was to save the government money. Now, given how much money goes into teacher compensation, the government actually might still have come out ahead in terms of the net savings here. I haven't done the math on that, but, you know, certainly this bill is large enough that other governments will take it seriously. Future governments will take it seriously. The current government may take it seriously, because other governments have used this tool before and will want to use it again, but now this court decision is going to, it may not stop them, but it's going to give them pause.
Well, you do wonder. I mean, the McGuinty government certainly saved money, but the Ford government won't. So you know right. that given that it takes 10 years for these things to finally wind their ways all the way through the courts, you never know. It's a tactic yes. that governments could go back to again and again.
Solve a problem for two election cycles? I mean, why not?
Yeah, there you go. We did have our Hamilton moment today, and as you know, I do like to follow the law here, so we need a Bill Davis moment to follow, and here it comes. I knew you were just waiting for it. It was actually Premier Bill Davis back in 1975 that gave teachers the right to strike and collectively bargain. Before that, can you imagine this? Before that, if teachers were not happy with what they were being paid, they simply resigned, sometimes en masse from school boards. That's the way it worked. And Mr. Davis thought that this was kind of crazy, that at the beginning of every year, every school year, you couldn't have this kind of uncertainty in the system. So he tried to bring some order to the process. And ever since, people have debated whether that was a good idea or a bad idea. For teachers, whom Mr. Davis mostly loved, it's been a very positive development. They have good wages. They have the best pension plan anywhere. On the other hand, you want to give the other hand?
Well, I mean, I think the other hand is that let's say it is sometimes difficult to make our agreements with teachers' unions in this province, and every premier, in my lifetime at least, has discovered this at one point or another. You know, the best example, I think everybody would agree, really, is in 1995, when teachers' unions, and you know, they were not alone in the Ontario public sector, but, you know, teachers' unions went to war with Bob Rae's government, the NDP government of the day. They had their reasons for doing that. There was a lot of anger about the way the NDP had been, you know, seen to turn against organized labor, they felt. But the result of that was that the Progressive Conservatives under Mike Harris won in the 1995 election. And, you know, if teachers thought they had it bad under Ray, well, it got much, much worse for them under the Harris government. I do have to say, you know, fun little young McGrath history fact. I had a teacher in high school who admitted to me that he voted for Harris in the 1995 election. I'm the kind of dork who was talking provincial politics with his high school teachers in the late 1990s. But, you know, my teacher told me he was angry about things that had happened at Array. He thought that the province had, you know, gotten a bit out of control with the NDP. So, you know, he had a lot of reasons that a lot of other Harris voters had. He did not end up loving the results of the Harris government.
You don't say.
And I never did follow up with him. I had actually graduated out of that school by 1999. I'm reasonably confident he did not vote for the Tories in 1999. But of course, the Tories got reelected anyway.
With a higher percentage of the total vote, actually. You know, yeah. It reminds me of Brian Mulroney's old line, "Don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative."
Right.
And I do remember talking with a former secondary school teachers union leader. This is many, many years ago, who told me during the Mike Harris days, he said, "We used to think Bill Davis was so terrible. And then Mike Harris came along and we came to learn that the Davis days were like living in Camelot." So there you go. Well, we always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have that immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We do love your feedback, good, bad, or indifferent.
Here's one from The Mad Balmer, who wrote, "I moved here from Alberta this past year and was looking for a podcast to keep me updated on my new province's politics, and this is it. Steve and JMM are informative and keep things light in a time when most political podcasts are full of anger and partisanship. My issue with On Poly is that it's only once a week. Highly recommended." Thanks, Mad Balmer. I want to spell this out, that it's B-A-L-M-E-R, not the other kind of bomber. If anybody else has an email they want to send us, they can shoot it to us at onpolitics@tvo.org. We also want to remind you to read our weekly On Poly newsletter, which drops every Tuesday. You can subscribe to that at tvo.org/onpoly-newsletter. This week, we are talking about the events on Parliament Hill with the Federal Conservative Party, whose leader, Aaron O'Toole, was dethroned last week. O'Toole, of course, an Ontario MP, so we're using that is our excuse to talk about it.
Yes, and we answer the burning question, when do 73 votes count more than 50,000 votes? And you'll get the answer if you read that newsletter. Here now, my quote of the week. The two main opposition leaders weighed in on Doug Ford's comments about the convoy last week. First, Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca blasted Ford for being, in his view, too in favor of the convoy. You remember the God bless him comment. Then NDP leader Andrea Horvath took aim at Stephen Del Duca for his comments. Let's listen.
"After what you saw happen in Ottawa last Saturday, God bless the protesters? Did he say God bless Ottawa? Did he say I really feel for the people? He might have said it. I didn't hear it. Did he say I feel for Jim Watson? It's a tough set of circumstances. I want to talk to the mayor. I want to talk to the members of that council. I want to go and speak with small business owners who are suffering so brutally. Did he say any of that? No, he said, God bless the protesters. He picked. He made his choice. He made it clear. It's not the choice I would make."
The political shots back and forth, I don't really have time for it right now. I think what we really need to focus on is how do we make sure our hospitals are protected? How do we stop what's happening in Ottawa from happening in Toronto? And how do we support Ottawa and the people of Ottawa in terms of what's been happening, what they've been dealing with for a week now? If Stephen Del Duca wants to take shots at Doug Ford in that regard on the political side, you know, whatever. We're welcome to do so. I'm not there right now.
Andrea Horvath, and before that, Stephen Del Duca on the Truckers Convoy and the Premier.
And here's my quote of the week. This comes from Federal Minister of Emergency Preparedness Bill Blair on Monday, addressing the need for protests in Ottawa to come to an end.
"It is well past the time to bring this protest to an end. Canada is a peaceful nation, and we often serve as an example of hope to countries around the world. And we look after our neighbors and we treat each other with respect in this country. We do not threaten or intimidate our fellow citizens. We do not desecrate the National War Memorial. We don't dishonor statues dedicated to national heroes. And we do not tolerate individuals who wave flags riddled with symbols of hate and discrimination."
That was Federal Minister of Emergency Preparedness Bill Blair speaking to reporters on Monday.
And that is this week's episode of the On Poly Podcast, produced by Katie O'Connor, edited by Matthew O'Mara, production support from Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Halliwell. JMM, as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.